Hello, you're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society exists to equip and encourage Christian scholars to serve the church as a center of cultural and civic renewal. Through our events, publications, and podcasts, we provide the space and opportunities that Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox scholars need for professional growth and intellectual discipleship. Since 2012, we have been building a network of friends with a love for our core themes, tradition, place, and things divine, and with a genuine commitment to the church and the life of the mind. To learn more about us, our events, this podcast, our journal, Pietas, to sign up for our newsletter and make your tax-deductible gift, please go to ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society, and before we get started, please join me in a brief prayer. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, we pray, O Lord, that you would bless our conversation and that all we say and do would bring glory and honor to you. Amen. I am grateful to be joined today by Mr. Matthew K. Michaels. Matthew K. Michaels is a professional bookbinder and writer and the owner of Black Cowl Bindery. He is an oblate of the Order of St. Benedict, associated with St. Vincent Archabbey in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. He studied political science, philosophy, and Catholic studies at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota and earned a master's in theology at the Catholic International University. He is a scholar on the diaconate and comments frequently on monastic spirituality for the laity. Previously, Matthew served several years in the United States Army as an enlisted soldier and then an infantry officer. And he is originally from the farmlands of Wisconsin, but he now splits his time between St. Paul, Minnesota and Steubenville, Ohio, and loving to be the father of two wonderful toddlers. Welcome to the show, Matt.
It's great to be with you, Josh. Thanks so much for letting me come on and speak with you today.
Yeah, man. So I want to begin by talking about your business and then build on that and just kind of see where it goes. So you're a professional bookbinder. I'm hoping there's not a lot of confusion as to what that means. If you've encountered it, go ahead and give us a definition. But I want to start with this, actually. What is a bindery as it actually is? And then why is yours called the Black Cowl Bindery?
Yeah, great question. It does cause confusion every once in a while. I think usually people think that means that I'm a publishing house, and I'm not a publishing house, so I don't like collect, you know, authors and do contracts and publish works. Really, what a bookbinder does is the physical, you know, actual task of creating a physical book. And that's really what a bookbinder does. So not necessarily an author per se, not a publishing and distributing house, but really the physical task of making a good quality hardcover book. Not always just books, of course. You know, anything you could imagine being put into a sort of a casing like that, could have sort of that hardcover thing. So like photo albums, portfolios, all different sorts of things, professional services as well. Creating, you know, stacks of forms in a, like a logbooks and stuff for custom work for specific businesses. So there's a lot of work that goes into that. That's very varied for all sorts of different clients. But really what it comes down to is, you know, I'm a bookbinder and I put my craft into physically creating quality, custom, handcrafted hardcover books, I guess, in a sense. And it really is just a really rewarding thing because I'm pouring my whole person into what I'm doing there with my bookbinding. And it's fun to always sort of explain to other people what it is and what it is and dispel some of the rumors. And I've got to say, it's so fun because the reaction that people tend to have invariably always comes as, oh, wow, that's terribly interesting. That's so cool. And it makes you feel pretty, you know, pretty important and pretty cool because I've never heard anybody say, oh, wow, that's so interesting when somebody says that they're an accountant. So no guff to any of the accountants out there listening to the podcast, but
I need you so bad, accountants. You're my help.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, yeah. So you do vital work. That's so great. And you do wonderful work for us. It's just always funny to hear, you know, people say, oh, that is so terribly interesting. Tell me more about that, you know, as opposed to being a CPA. So it's the little bit of fun thing I do there.
So why is it called a Black Cowl Bindery?
Absolutely. You know, so the name Black Cowl Bindery comes from the distinctive black cowls or hoods of the Benedictine monks. You know, the Benedictine monks in monasticism who've been, really tied to this, historical sense of like transcribing books. You think of the image, the medieval image of like a monk sitting in a cell, and he's like copying, hand transcribing, from one copy to another. So you create more books before there was the printing press. So there's a long-standing connection of tradition between monks, monasticism, and the Benedictines, and just the actual art of the book, one of the most powerful and influential things that has ever been devised by man. And myself being a Benedictine oblate, so sort of a lay member, a professed lay member, part of the Order of Saint Benedict, having that connection to monastic spirituality, having that connection to the monastery and the Benedictines, just it really made it, well, that's it seems like a great point of connection. And I think it rolls off the tongue pretty well, Black Cowl Bindery.
Yeah, you gotta get that. How did you personally get involved in this? Because you said, I read your bio and it said you're in the military, you got these really interesting degrees, and you went to bookbinding. How'd that happen?
Exactly. So, towards the end of my military career, I was in the National Guard, and then I was also working on the civilian side because you can have a civilian career in the National Guard. And what I was doing is I was being a fundraising consultant, working with nonprofits, specifically churches, to do large-scale capital campaigns, fundraising campaigns for their churches. And I felt like I really wanted to start working for myself. I saw the work that I did was super important, but I wanted to shift. I was wanting something more aligned with my values of something that was human scaled, local, organic, involved my whole person, not just, instead standing or sitting in front of a spreadsheet on a computer all day, really engaging my whole body and my work and in my labors and creating something physically tangible. Matthew Crawford talks a lot about this in his great book, which I'll plug here, Shop Class is Soul Craft, and a great, fantastic piece. And I was like, wow, I really may be thinking about a career shift and working for myself. And I had these books, I had these paperback editions of, a three-volume series is one that I really like, but it was only available in paperback. I was like, man, I'd love to have a hardcover edition of these. I happened to find a bookbinder locally in my city, and he was able to do the work. And I came back to him another time, and a time after that, I said, hey, you ever thought about having an apprentice? And he's like, oh, geez, this older gentleman who's been doing this for 40 years and always worked by himself. He's like, oh, geez, I never thought of having an apprentice before. I'm like, oh, okay, no problem. Just think about it. I eventually, keep coming back for more work. And then he says, Matthew, if you're really terribly interested, I'll show you how to do these ones that you just brought in, and how to, turn these paperbacks into hardcovers. And you could do these ones yourself. And that was the foot in the door. Worked under him, learned under him. And then for the past year and a half, I've been really striking out on my own and building up my own business and working with clients locally and nationwide. And that's the lot. I guess I don't want to say a short story, but it's really a fun way to get into it.
That is cool. I mean, that whole world of apprenticeship often seems like something that's lost. I mean, it exists in small pockets, and it just happens to be here and there every once in a while. But it's something that we're missing. And I think it's a beautiful way to get involved in something, because it's a way to learn things relationally, and in a particular place, right? So like I can get on, I actually did before I got on this, when I was just kind of preparing for this podcast, I did what I normally do with crafts. I look on YouTube and like, basics of bookbinding, and just to see if I, just to get a visual for what it was. And I think to myself, first of all, I don't think I don't have the dexterity, I don't think, or the what's the word, the fine motor skills to do this. But even if I, you can learn lots of things on YouTube, but the relationship with someone who's done this for a long time and in a particular place, I think, shapes the way you learn and get good at a craft. And so I think that's an important piece of that, which you're welcome to comment on. And then
Oh, abs yeah,
I also want to
absolutely.
just I want to add before you do that, I want to add that a plug for Matthew Crawford's book, Shop Craft is Soul Craft, because it is absolutely a fantastic book if you've never read it. Absolutely good. I remember reading it though, and getting to the end of it, it's like I have no skills that relate to this right away.
One of those books that really makes you reevaluate your life choices. It's very funny. It's like, am I even doing the right thing that I want to do with my life? And those are good questions every once in a while to probably stop you in your tracks and ask. So Matthew really kicked off all of that. I think he wrote that book probably like almost 20 years ago. And it's so influential now. Highly recommend it for anybody who, if they want to have, I don't want to say an existential crisis of a career, but it's a great book nonetheless, because you learn so much, I think, about yourself and where you would want your priorities to lie, if nothing else.
Yeah. And we've had a lot of, this has become kind of unintentionally a common theme on the show. We brought on, I don't know if you know, David Michael Phelps at Harmel Academy. There's these guys who are putting together a St. Dunstan's Academy in Virginia, where, and they're giving a session here at the upcoming conference in Virginia. And there's this notion of common arts education. And so I'd like you to comment on that previous remark about kind of apprenticeship in place and the relational nature of it, but also this notion of, if you've heard of this kind of common arts education, as some call it, where a given trade or craft is given a major role in intellectual and spiritual formation. And I'm wondering how you might relate bookbinding both to that kind of apprenticeship in place and this relational learning, as well as kind of this movement, especially in the Christian world, of toward common arts education, where you use something like, in this case, it might be mechanics or timber framing or maybe in your case, bookbinding, as an instrument of intellectual and spiritual formation.
Oh yeah, you know, Harmel and St. Dunstan's, and also I know the people over at the College of St. Joseph the Worker in
Ohio. Oh yeah, I
Ohio.
Just heard about them yesterday. Yeah,
fantastic people, and they really have, I think, their heart in the right place and their heads, you know, like screwed on straight and like focused right, like steel, like flint, right on the target of where we need to be going. I think that all of those institutions are doing really important and really insightful work of like reading the signs of the times. I think it's so wonderful, and you. Your point about a common arts education. Well, the thing about bookbinding, I think for a good bookbinder to really be a great bookbinder, is you need to not just know the physical tasks of like a repetitive process of how to create a custom book or a hardcover book. I think a great bookbinder has an appreciation for the literary tradition, and is able to have a mind for design, and is able to have a mind for color theory, and able to have, you know, an understanding of all of these things and be able to relate them all together. Because you can, you know, you could become a robot, I guess, of just, you know, being a human, you know, flesh and bones kind of assembly machine of like, okay, well, I take the piece of paper and then I fold it and then I put glue on this part and then that's it, which isn't terribly inspired. A great bookbinder is really able to say, okay, well, I have this copy of, like, I don't know, a certain copy of books. I'm like, I did Killers of the Flower Moon recently, the book that inspired the recent, I think, what was it, Scorsese movie with Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yep.
And you say, okay, well, what about what is going to make this book? What kind of casing, what kind of artistic elements can I use to be able to create something that's fitting for what this book is? Or, you know, Canterbury Tales, or Count of Monte Cristo, or maybe it's like a textbook, it's nonfiction. So maybe it's like an old copy of, you know, Merck's Medical Guide, or a family heirloom Bible that somebody from the 20s that somebody is said is totally beat up, but like to have it, you know, put into a new casing or something. And you have to have an appreciation for the literary tradition and a knowledge of it, and understand good design and be an artist. And that takes the physical act of bookbinding and creates it into an art. And so, you know, you could be just, you know, a hands-on like a mechanic, but really taking it to the next level, you need to know other things. So you have to be holistically integrated. And I like to think that I do that quite well. These colleges, these schools, these academies, and also St. Martin's Academy, which is more of like a boys, like I think middle and high school thing that's out in, I think, Kansas, is doing a lot of that as well, but not at the college level, but at like more of the school, middle and high school level. For boys, like we need to have a holistic and well-integrated approach to what we do. I certainly don't want the guy who's going to be framing my house, running power lines, and like putting plumbing, you know, sewage plumbing through my house, to be the guy who is too stupid to go to possibly even go to any college and has no idea about anything. You know, it's like, it doesn't bode well for how I think about, you know, how my sewage lines in my house are going to hold up after years, if I know that the only people there are going to be, you know, kids, 18-year-olds who are just too stupid to, you know, go to college. I'm sorry, that sounds a little bit rough around the edges, but I think you get the message that I'm getting at there. Especially after what, 20 years now of sending pretty much anybody with a warm body into a 4-year, you know, liberal arts education, or you know, going to school for something, and really taking these people out of the trades and taking these people out of, I guess, crafts, things that aren't necessarily like, you know, because bookbinding is not like a masonry, for example, you know, where it's just like a skilled trade, you know, cut and dry. You could do a lot of artistic stuff with masonry, or like carpentry, framing and whatnot. I like to think of what I do as more of like a craft. And those crafts really come alive and take the fullness of their shape and form when you have, I think, an appreciation for everything else around it. So if you meet a bookbinder who doesn't read anything, we'll run away.
Right.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I think there's that, maybe just to step back from the bookbinding piece a little bit, there's just try and clarify what you're saying, because I'm thinking of the plumbing example, the plumber, the HVAC, the masonry. It's not directly attached to a reading career necessarily. And so I'm wondering if there's, you know, I wouldn't necessarily want the person who's unable to go to college doing a, or, you know, being a bookbinder, because again, there's likely, and I think you've already hinted at this, that there's a relationship between the art of the binding and the content of the actual book, right? Or at least a relationship to whatever, wherever the book comes from, in the particular place, or the family that gives you that family Bible, as you mentioned. I'm wondering, you know, and this is one of the things that I would bring up at Harmel Academy too, which they're just doing such great work. It's interesting to think how, you know, what difference does it make to any, you know, any of these crafts or trades that they've read Augustine and Plato. It makes more sense with the bookbinding, right? Because there's a relationship between the text of the literature and the binding. But why would a mechanic read Aristotle or Aquinas?
Oh yeah, well, I think the thing is that it provides a level of inspiration, you know, so that we can be inspired in our work and love what we do. You know, if the noble pagans of ancient Greece are talking about, you know, virtue and eudaimonia, and they're talking about, okay, well, you know, you're going to find success, or happiness rather, you're going to find this true lasting happiness in your life, not from money or like wealth, fame, popularity, power, you know, temporal power in that sense, but you're going to find it in like virtuous living, and you're going to be able to incorporate that into your work. Well, then the mechanic is going to say, well, I want to do that. Well, I want to be happy. So maybe I shouldn't be just blowing my money on like 27% interest pickup trucks. Maybe the guy who does carpentry is like, I'm not going to get off on the lineman who works, you know, the county lineman, or the guy who works out in the oil fields in North Dakota is not going to be like, well, let's go to the strip club on the weekends. And then all of a sudden I've lost most of my money that I earned that week. He's going to actually find lasting happiness by knowing the things from which he can read from the classics and the great masters. And also, because you are reading those things, hopefully you're just getting exposed a little bit more and more to the grander tradition of Western civilization, the greater cultural heritage that we're beneficiaries of. And so you read, sure, you can read Aristotle and Plato and Marcus Aurelius and all this stuff, but then maybe you might, you know, learn a thing or two about ancient Rome. And if you're going to learn a thing or two about ancient Rome or ancient Greece, then you might, if you're a Mason, see, well, beautiful pictures of amazing, you know, buildings that were built during the period of antiquity. And you're like, oh my gosh, have you seen the Pantheon? That thing is really freaking cool. I'm a Mason. I built things with blocks. You know, I can do stuff. Like, maybe I want to try my hand at figuring out if I could do a little bit of stone cutting at some point. Wouldn't that be pretty neat? And so you find that these young guys coming in, if they want to get into this, it's important for them to read these things so that they can, one, live virtuously and work virtuously, and two, be inspired to do great things. You're not condemned to a life of mediocrity and obscurity just because you decide to become a carpenter or a mason or a welder, is that you can actually maybe find inspiration in what the whole of the Western tradition has to offer and what it's produced in the past, and say, well, I want to do that too. dang, I want to build something cool, like the aqueducts of the ancient Romans that I see. Isn't that, engineering and that craft that they've put in that has lasted for, 2,500 years? Isn't that amazing and marvelous? Well, I think that's pretty awesome, and I can do that too.
I think it gets to this, one of the things, Catholics talk about this as well, but on the Protestant side where I come from, there's, especially in the last 20, 30 years, there's been this huge, a lot of conversations about the notion of vocation, right? And this notion of what does it mean to work to the glory of God? There's a long tradition of this in all our, the respective traditions that we come from, but I've always been struck by, a lot of times we struggle to give a good explanation for this, and kind of the way you're describing this really is, I think, is very thoughtful because it's a way of thinking of everything you're doing as not simply transactional or for material benefit, right? It's a very classical idea to not just do that, and that okay, I'm going here not just to make money when I go to help this house with their plumbing, right? I'm actually I'm doing something that's actually virtuous. I want to do this well. I'm helping people live better. I'm serving others. And that at the end of the day, what I'm doing is I'm glorifying God, and I am connecting to this greater tradition of virtue and love for one another, and helping my community in some way. It sounds so elevated, and the struggle we have, and I certainly struggle with this, is that is to really get your mindset there, right? Because culturally, it just seems so mundane and so oversimplistic, right? Where it's hard to tell the person in the trades and the, or I shouldn't say it isn't hard to tell. It's hard to really let it sink in that when you're in these trades and these crafts, you when you do it well, you are glorifying God. You are doing something that I don't know if it's right to call it a ministry or not. That's a different question. But it is, there's something sacred about it.
Yeah, and I would just have the young guy just tap into the natural predisposition that these guys who do this amazing work in the trades, I would just have them tap into that predisposition they have to recognize good, solid work that lasts. Because if there's anything that people in the trades, are able to tell you, is that they take pride in good work that they get done, and they recognize that in others. So when they see like a really stellar electrical setup in a breaker box in somebody's home, and it's like all super clean and it makes total sense and it's easily like maintainable, and if you need to go in repairs or stuff like that, other electricians will look at that and they will praise that, and they say, that's good work, that is so awesome, that is solid, that is something like, I don't know if they would use the word virtue, but it's like that's a sign of some virtue. You are knowledgeable in your craft. You've perfected that through some application of your whole person into this craft that you do, into this task and this skill. And they recognize that. And I think that if you were to just have them tap into that natural predisposition, my God, I can't say
That's a
that
hard
word
word.
today. Yeah. I can't even speak English, and here I am on a podcast. But if I'm asking them to tap into that, then I think they'll probably start to pick that up. What you're doing is actually something of value. And every man knows that what he does, if he's actually doing something that produces an output of anything meaningful, he's going to start to see that. We just have to help everybody that we can see that the what they do produce is meaningful. We don't want to have a lack of meaning in our work. There is always meaning to be found in the work. And we're always the beneficiaries of a sort of a heritage, a pedagogy that's brought us to here. The guy who lays bricks is the recipient of a long line of bricklayers who've, done all sorts of styles and all sorts of, architectural elements and all these, engineering developments on how do you create and fabricate and manufacture and then lay and repair and then maintain bricks. The guy who does, same thing with stone cutting and bookbinding. Like I learned from my guy. Who was a master binder for 40 years, and we're receiving, like I said, like the 1500 year tradition of monastic, passing on the creation of the book.
What's the first book that was ever bound?
That's a great question. What do you mean, like a printing press? Because you have you have tomes, of course, that existed before the modern printing
Right.
press.
So I mean before the printing press. So in the Middle Ages, at some point, they th because th that's essentially where the craft begins, right? Somewhere in the Middle Ages, the monks start to do it, right?
Yeah, I got to imagine scripture. It's always a safe bet, I guess. Let's just
Scripture's
go with
probably the
scripture. I don't
same.
really
Jesus
know.
is the answer. That's
I'm
what
gonna,
I'm.
yeah, exactly. Let's just sound confident and let somebody just send an angry letter. It's like, this guy doesn't know jack squat. But I'm gonna be confident in it.
It'll end up being something random, right? It'll be that someone went small, because one of the things you might have been the case is it may not have been scripture because it's so large. The first person to do it may have tried to do it with, like a small collection of stories or something in the Middle Ages. We'll end up finding out after the show. Well, I want to switch gears here a little bit, but at the same time, thinking about this talk about virtue, doing things well, human scale. And talk about your role and your life running and being part of a small business, and how that kind of relates to some of these same themes that we're talking about, in the notion of virtue and doing these things to the glory of God.
Yeah, well, that's oh, yeah. There's certainly much to be said there. The small business aspect of it, I think it's super important. I think that in our modern age, in our contemporary period, we have this almost hyper reliance on large multinational corporations and the idea of just a human scaled economy. Of having a community-driven economy, not to be totally like localist and not to be entirely sort of a Chestertonian integralism, but you just see. Here's a question I like to ask people: if you didn't have chain retail locations, where would you go? Like, they all just disappeared tomorrow. All your Walmarts, all your Targets. All your CVS's and Walgreens, all your major grocery retailers, if they all just like disappeared tomorrow, where would you go to get toothpaste? And then people are like, that is a very good question because, and it should actually awaken something in us that we've maybe become super hyper reliant on these gigantic multinational corporations that aren't really maybe. They aren't invested in the well-being of the communities in which they serve. I think, not the name drop, but Dollar General is probably the most egregious example of this. I would probably just firebomb Dollar General's en masse if I could get away with it.
Firebomb them.
Yeah,
We're
I
gonna
know
need
that's a
to.
little
We might need to edit
drastic.
that one out. I
Yeah,
don't
we'll edit that. Yeah,
know.
absolutely. I've never done it, by the way. I don't condone arson. Just have a nice time on the 4th of July and don't hurt anybody. I think
They
that's the
sell
extent of it.
fireworks, so
Yeah,
I
they
mean.
do. Oh, well, there we go. Perfect. Make it look like an accident. Yeah, but no, but I'm always about saying, okay, well, how do I want to orient my life? Because I know that what I want to do with my work, I understand it's important to have these sort of small businesses, independent, local, supporting human-scaled economies, not multinational chain, like things that take a supply chain from all around the world that creates actually once you get set past a certain point of integrated supply chains that are global, it actually becomes more unstable because once one ship gets stuck in the Panama Canal for like 48 hours, the whole entire global stock market like just collapses for at least a certain period of time. Somebody's a little bit slow getting through the Suez Canal and all of a sudden there's huge backlogs of being able to manufacture something. I think it's a little weird. So maybe there's actually something healthy in saying I want to maybe move away from whatever I was doing before and serve my community more directly and have my community benefit because all of this transaction is happening within my community. I'm invested in the well-being of the community because these are the people that buy from me. And the community is like, invested in me because we, the whatever profits are generated here stay local. And what we find is that this is actually probably a more holistic and well-integrated society that has a greater level of like care for each other. Because we're all in the same boat together. Not to be completely cut off from any sort of, significant supply chain of sort of course. We live in a modern age. We can't live, I think, without commodities. But of course, maybe we just take a step back and say, where can I buy toothpaste that isn't at Target? Where can I buy clothes that are not going to be a major retailer. You know, where can I go for these things? Where can I support my local businesses? And then we find that actually we become more humanly connected because we're making those lifestyle changes.
Well, and I think you're getting at an important piece of this here is that, you know, because I can hear the economists in our community who I love you all very much. There's much to be said about economies of scale, efficiency, keeping things affordable, and that, I mean it's unlikely that there's going to be a movement of the world that's going to get rid of the Amazons and Walmarts of the world, but at the same time, there is a sense in which we the even if it costs more to go to the local non-chain restaurant, or to go to that small business or that local clothing shop, where you know the person who sold it, you probably know where they sourced the material, etc. The relationship that you have in your community just through those economic transactions, I think is very, very valuable. It's something that you can't necessarily quantify. And so I agree with you. And having a small business and also patronizing them as you can. You know, one of the things too, we could get into this. There's so many policies that work against their development, though. I think one of the things I've been learning more and more about is zoning laws in particular have made it so much harder.
Yeah, the growing amount of urbanists, I think, like healthy urbanists. Yeah, the rising on the internet has been, I think, a huge boon to America. You know, but once you know it, it's like a cursed knowledge. It's like once you know it, you can't unsee suburbs.
Right, right.
And you're like, I fly over, like I'm on an airplane, and I'll like be landing in Minneapolis, St. Paul at the airport, and you're passing over like these large swaths of nothing but homogeneous suburbs with street designs that make no sense. And you're like, once you understand, you know, a healthy sense of urban design, and you know, well integrated communities in terms of zoning, you see that and you're like, now I can't unsee it, and I want to rage, and I'm in the middle of my flight. But you're right, it creates this human element of cohesion in high trust society, because you actually start to know and actually become engaged with the people, I guess, who you are patronizing. So I could go to a large, you know, supermarket retailer. I could go to Target, or I could go to Walmart, where they sell, obviously now they sell groceries at a lot of these locations, and I could pick up Tyson chicken. And I could, you know, I don't know any of the people who work at the Target. There's like hundreds of people who work at that Target, and I don't know anything about the chicken, where it was raised from. Or in my case, like I go to a local business, a little butchery and deli that's right in my neighborhood, minutes from my house, and they source, you know, all the meats that I could ever want, but like from just a few local farms in the region outside of the Twin Cities where I, you know, reside. And I know the people there because there's like six people on staff, and they have a little supply chain of getting, you know, stuff butchered and then brought into the store and whatnot. But like when I go to them and I say, "Oh, Nick, it's so good to see you." And it's Matthew, what's going on? Hey, and you know what he'll do? He'll give me meat for like a discounted price. It's like, oh, this has been sitting out for like a day or two. I kind of want to get rid of it. Here you go. Go ahead. You know, this is for you to take. And we find that there's less waste. We find that there's more of a human connection. I'm invested in Nick's personal life because I know him so much, and vice versa. We know each other. It creates a cohesive and high trust society. And all that money stays for us to be able to do, have a greater sense of financial stability in our communities, you know, because all the profits kind of stay local. You know, it's not shipped off to Walmart headquarters in Arkansas. You know, if you're shopping at a Target in, I don't know, Texas, you know, that the profits that are generated there are not going to go back to Minnesota where you aren't from. And, you know, because we have those things, we end up saying, well, if we're spending more, yeah, I guess it's a little bit more expensive, but that means that everybody has more money in their own pockets. You know, so that's the whole idea of having a human scaled economy. Is that these things stay at the human level and not on these like gigantic international lines of, I guess, following the dollar, if you would say,
right.
Which creates not only, I think a healthier and more stable financial environment for communities and individuals and families, but actually creates a more high trust society, creates a more cohesive, you know, community that is interested and invested in its well-being and in a human flourishing. Because human flourishing is not just, you know, how many cool trinkets can I get at the lowest possible price on the shelf. It's well, how do I actually be like fully alive as a human and feel like I don't want to like you just die because I
Well,
did my job.
It's also I think there's also an element of just getting to know the people in your wealth are those connections that you make in your community. I, as an academic, I've moved around so many times and I finally landed in a place where I hope to be the rest of my life here in Holland, Michigan. And by the way, the philosophy you were just describing is why I drink all the local West Michigan beer. Shout out to all them.
We love our microbrewers. We love
right.
our microbrewers. Please, like all of your major beer manufacturers in the United States are owned by foreign companies.
I know.
It's like, I feel like we're getting so deep into a conversation about economics, but it does matter. But it's kind of funny that we kind of naturally drifted into that. And then we wrap it all up with like, yes, we love our local brewers. Microbreweries, yes. I wish we would like less hyper focus on IPAs though. Because like me, I hate IPAs. I'm like the only white guy in like a 5 mile radius that doesn't like IPAs.
You're going to.
Like, oh my goodness.
Well, you're going to have to, I'm going to have to agree to disagree here. I love IPAs. So you're just wrong. Okay. But I get crap for that. My wife says they all taste like soap. I disagree. Maybe I need to wash my mouth out. And so that's just what's happening. I don't want to go down that, but I think there's lots of what you're saying. We get into a lot of those topics at the Ciceronian Society Conference. You know, historically we have been very much a venue for these localist conversations. And I hope that continues. I mean, there's certainly folks among us who it might be less localist. I mean, that there's no litmus test there, but it's a huge part of our identity going back since we began. People reading Wendell Berry or G.K. Chesterton and others. And I think there's one of the appeals that we have kind of unintentionally fallen into is there's this desire. I think about 1984, right? Where I can't think of the main character's name. What's his name?
It's like Watson or something. You know, it's by his last name, I think.
Oh, and what is his name?
Yeah,
I can't think of it. The dude. And the dude, he's writing in his journal, and his whole thing is just, you know, he's wrestling against the state so that he can be human. In a way, that is a lot of what we talk about. What is it? How are we resisting those forces that are trying to reduce us to something less than human? And I think that's an important piece of this here. Anyway, I want to move on to one, maybe two last topics here. Because you're a great example of a principle that the Ciceronian Society lives by, in that scholars don't always have a university affiliation. They may be a binder. They may be a homeschool mom. They may be someone who's just retired. They may be, they may have been a cashier at the Walmart, for all I know. That hasn't happened yet, but you're more than welcome. If you, hey, you got a paper on Augustine, my mind will be blown away.
I will say, I'll interrupt you for a moment. It's like, it's funny because I had a good friend, I have a very good friend of mine who's now doing a doctorate in theology at Ave Maria in Florida.
Yep.
And in the meantime, he was just working like on the floor of a Target here in Minnesota. So I always found that funny. It's like, yes, this is a guy who writes on Aquinas, like very high level, analysis of Aquinas. And he's got his, cute little red shirt on and helping people at Target. So don't discredit them all. Love you, Alex. If you're out there listening to Ciceronian Society, you know who you are. We love our erudite Target employees.
Well, I mean, actually, I lived in Washington, D.C. for 4 years. I survived it. And, there is a unusual number of people. If you go to a restaurant, you go to a store, it is not unlikely that someone who's helping you is either getting a PhD or has one. And the same thing was true when I remember at one point I was a waiter at a chain restaurant in Eastern Michigan, and this family was having an argument about they started saying something about religion and politics. I can't remember what it was, and they someone said something about Martin Luther, and the other one said something about Thomas Aquinas, and I just couldn't believe what just happened, first of all. And they said, oh, you wouldn't understand, you're a waiter. And I said, well, actually, that was one of the
so
most
fantastic.
Interesting conversations. Like, it only happened once. And I was like, I'm actually, I just, you know, I'm getting a political philosophy PhD. And because they're, you know, we come in all shapes and sizes. And I'm, you know, this will be your first conference, right? With us?
Yeah, I'm very grateful that this will be the first with Ciceronian Society is going to be the first conference
How
that
did
I'll be
you,
presenting at.
yeah. Okay. How did you hear about us?
You know, I had another good friend of mine, a colleague of mine who is an academic, a scholar, like working as a faculty member at a university. He sent me a call. He sent me the call for papers. And I looked into you guys, and I was very, very excited about, well, not only the mission and sort of the sort of mindset of the Ciceronian Society, but also the topic at hand. And I was like, oh man, I've got something that I've been thinking about for the longest time. And I threw together my paper topic for proposal. And obviously, you guys have very good taste at the Ciceronian Society because you accepted it. So I'm very grateful and just jazzed, so excited to be able to talk upcoming. I think in a Well, at least at the time of this recording in March upcoming, talk about my paper, which is going to be on the w American genre Western and the formation of masculine virtue. This is kind of the title that I have going with it. And I love Westerns and like Wild West Westerns, not like, the great tradition of the West West, but really like good old fashioned cowboys and Indians and sheriffs and stagecoach style West. And that genre is so, I think, so well suited for helping form good masculine virtue of the magnanimous man, the omamanus in young men, especially today. I think there's something particularly well suited in the American Western as a genre and as the archetype of the American Western hero in those stories to help young men form formation. And if you don't mind, I'd like to actually just take like a few minutes to just talk about a few things
Go
about that
ahead.
if you
Don't give
wouldn't
us the whole
mind.
paper, because
Oh
I think
no,
this
it's a
will come
tease. You
out.
gotta actually register. It might be too late.
It
Registrations
is
might be closed.
too, you know what, it is too late to register, but this will go out probably before the conference, so you might want to, don't give us too much.
Oh no, I won't. Okay, that's perfect then. I'll just say this. In a time and an age where, we have a lot of these action heroes. Think of like the 1980s and Schwarzenegger, and Sylvester Stallone in First Blood. It wasn't called Rambo, it's just called First Blood. But like these big hulking, muscly guys. And this idea of masculinity was, how big are your muscles? How fast and powerful is your car? How beautiful are the women under every one of your shoulders? How thick is your cigar? All of this stuff and more. And that's what a manly man is. Look back to the Western, actually. Look back to those classic Westerns, not the spaghetti Westerns. It's actually my unpopular opinion that I don't like the spaghetti Westerns. I don't like the Clint Eastwood movies. It like blows people's minds. I think that's the most like the egregious thing that anybody has ever heard me say. But if you look back at the classic Westerns of the 50s, in the maybe the early 60s and the 30s, 40s, you look back at those. There's one example that I think is the perfect, I think, foil to this erroneous, effeminate view of masculinity that is offered by like the big hulking muscles and money and cars and whatever it may be. Look to the 1960s filming of The Magnificent Seven, the one from the 60s, not the newer version, but look to The Magnificent Seven.
The with
There is
Yul
a
Brynner.
scene. Yeah, Yul Brynner, great. And Steve McQueen, great. So look at that movie. There's a scene about, towards the end where Yul is his character is a cowboy and he's been hired as a gunman to help train up a bunch of like local ranchers in the small Mexican farming village to defend against somebody who's exploiting them. Anyways, and they're gonna come, so they gotta fight him off. And these young boys who've been watching this cowboy this whole time, this whole like month that they've been preparing, they kind of sneak into his room late at night. And he wakes up and he's like, "What are you guys doing here?" And the kids are like, "Oh, sorry, mister. We didn't mean to scare you, but we thought we couldn't help it. We think that you are so brave. You're so brave coming and helping. And this is the thing that gets you." What does Yul Brynner's character say? He says, "You think that I'm brave because I carry a gun? Let me tell you, your fathers are far braver men than me. Yeah, I sure have a gun and I roam around, but your fathers are out there and they have to provide for you and your mothers, their wives and their children. They have to toil, day in and day out in the fields with no thanks and no guarantee of any success. And they can't go wherever they want to go, when they want to go. I roam about and I don't have anybody to sort of tether me down to one place. I got all these options open for me. And your fathers are far braver men than me." And I think that just struck me so profoundly when I had first watched that movie many years ago. And it has always stuck with me, the idea of, you think that I'm brave because I carry a gun? Let me tell you, your fathers are far braver men than me. And if we can find those moments in all these classic Westerns, of not only movies, but of kind of the Zane Grey sort of novels as well, then we can actually find archetype for the magnanimous man within, you know, within the Western genre, of somebody who, you know, in a time of lawlessness is well ordered and operates by principles, even if others aren't, who, you know, is willing to sacrifice, who is willing to love, who is willing to actually change, have his mind changed and find true happiness in something maybe other than gunfighting. You know, is a man of justice. He's a man of character. He's a man of principles. He's a man of great bravery and integrity. And this is the classic archetype of the Western hero. And why not show these to young guys? And yeah, so come to the Ciceronian Society, you know, you check it out. Just read Westerns, you know, with your young boys, you know, watch Western movies with your young boys, and help them to find that, to inspire them. I hope that doesn't give away too much, but I think it's the fun highlights that I wanted to focus on. It's my favorite genre, so I was so pumped to be able to present it with you guys.
Yeah, and there's some other things going on with that too. I think one of the papers on that panel might be out about Gladiator, or maybe they gave it last year. But you know, there's that need for, or how do I say this, a recovery of that classical Christian imagination, or at least the elements of it that lead us to not only masculine virtues, but just those classical and Christian virtues that have sustained the best of Western civilization for thousands of years. That is a huge part of what we want to do, and what we end up drawing a lot of people to us for that reason. Actually, a huge number, and your paper was no exception to this, I would say the dominant theme of the proposals this year was the intersection of art, literature, and movies with questions of virtue, essentially, or philosophy or theology, which is fine by me, because I think there's so much a need to recover and restore a moral imagination rooted in the Western tradition. And so the more scholarship we have moving in that direction, the better. And so I think I'm grateful that folks like you find us. And I think it's only going to increase in the years ahead. So yeah. Just before we go, I want to make sure, if folks want to learn more about what you do as a binder, where do they go?
Yeah, you can check me out at my website for the bindery, which is www.blackcowlbindery.com. Not only can you find information about me and my bindery and my work, you can also find a gallery of past examples of stuff that I've done, repairs and custom new bindings as well. There's a store where there's a couple items usually up at any given point in time that are ready for purchase, like ready to ship, that I have just made and ready to go, and a way to contact and reach out for me if you wanted to explore any options that you might have for something custom you might want done. Maybe you are an academic. Maybe you would like to have perhaps a dissertation that you're finishing up. Maybe you'd like to have that bound in a custom leather binding. Maybe you'd like to have, you're on the tail end of your academic career and you'd like to have kind of your portfolio of all your published work in one volume. You know, that would be something really cool as well. Or if you say, hey, I have these paperbacks, that, like, can you make them into a hardcover to look nice in my library? Or I have this old book that belonged to my father and his father before him, or my mom, or whatever. can you repair this, because it's all busted up the heck? Can you repair this? I can do all of those things and more. Check it out at www.blackcowlbindery.com. And it's cowl, like COWL, not cow as in the America's Dairyland. They're my favorite animals, but that's not the name of my bindery. It's Black Cowl, as in the hood, COWL, bindery.com.
Cows are definitely one of my favorite animals to eat. I'll definitely agree with you there. So, well, thank you so much, Matt. Or Matthew, I really appreciate you being on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much, Josh. I really appreciate you and the Ciceronian Society. I'm grateful to be on the podcast today. And thanks to your listeners as well.
Yeah, we'll see you in just over a month. All right.
Absolutely. Peace be with you.
Yes. And all right, you've been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. If you've enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll consider signing up for our newsletter and joining us for a future event. At the time of this recording, February 7th, our 2025 conference is sold out, but we're working on confirming a date and location for our 2026 conference very soon. That will be announced at the 2025 conference. And if you're with our newsletter, you'll also get that news. We'll also be launching a membership program this year, so keep an eye out for that. Be sure to rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, and check out our website at ciceroniansociety.org. Now may the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us all evermore. Thank you for listening.